Cześć, słuchacie podcastu o języku. Ja się nazywam Marysia.
A ja Paweł.
W dzisiejszym odcinku rozmawiamy o języku i o władzy. Rozmawiamy z naszym gościem,
białoruskim badaczem dyskursu, doktorem Antonem Dinersteinem, który jest związany z Instytutem Slawistyki Polskiej Akademii Nauk.
Rozmawiamy o tym, jak takie konkretne słowa jak władza, naród czy państwo kształtują nasze myślenie o polityce, o społeczeństwie i o relacjach między różnymi państwami. Na przykładzie Białorusi, dyskursu rosyjskojęzycznego w Białorusi, pokazujemy, jak abstrakcyjne pojęcia mogą zyskać osobowość i jak język potrafi ukrywać przemoc i różne nawyki, które utrwalają podziały społeczne. Cała rozmowa jest w języku angielskim. Jeśli chcecie, możecie przeczytać przetłumaczoną rozmowę na język polski, całość, na naszej stronie www.ojęzyku.pl. Na tej stronie znajdziecie też mnóstwo innych artykułów na temat języka, języków, również na temat dyskursu. Teraz zapraszamy Was na rozmowę. So we started with a short introduction, but I would like to ask you a question to make everyone at the same place so that we know what's the situation, what's the political landscape of Belarus right now. And later on, we will go into your linguistic research, but we need to set the common ground right now.
So basically, Belarus is the post-Soviet republic. And then in 1994, the person who is currently in power in Belarus, Alexander Lukashenko, has won the first presidential election in 1994. And since then, he's been in power basically for 31 years already. Now situation has worsened after the 2020 political protests presidential election. And currently there are a lot of political prisoners. People get into jail for basically liking posts on Facebook or commenting something. So basically, if you are a Belarusian in Belarus and you do something which is against official political position, then you're in trouble. So this is what is happening there. And many people left Belarus, approximately maybe 500,000 people since 2020 to different countries. Many of the Belarusians are in Poland, some in Lithuania and in other countries.
What made you focus specifically about language as a way to understand politics, and why is this so important to talk about that?
When I was doing my research, I paid attention to specific words, basically, keywords that people use when they discuss political topics. And then I decided to see whether these same words are used by officials or politicians or oppositional figures, activists in the media and public landscape, public discourse and social media, for example, and in everyday interactions. And basically, I figured out that a set of keywords that are present in most of the political discussions, such words as like power, state, people, sovereignty, basically universal political concepts, or terms that are used in any context when you speak about politics. But in Belarus, Russian language is predominantly used for communication and everyday talk. Belarusian is not so much used. And then I looked at Russian language political discourse in Belarus. So it appeared that these words, like for example, in Russian power, it will be vlast, like vladze in Polish, right? State will be государство. And these words in Russian language have linguistic roots that go back to, some of them go into Middle Ages, some of them to the times of Kievan Rus, for example, when people dragged ships with goods across the rivers, right, through the territory of what is modern-day Belarus. And then these words has these connotations of somebody controlling the situation. For example, the word power comes from volost, or vlada, vladar, vladika, all these same roots. It means like volost was a territorial unit, for example. Vlast is power. And then you see how territory and some kind of political attributes are connected to one together. So these connotations travel through time, basically. But now there is another problem. When you use these words, such as power, for example, in Russian, vlast, it can be used as an attribute, like impersonal, something like somebody gets power to do something. Or, for example, in liberal democracies, somebody gets power through votes. So basically, people represents people who gave him power to do something. In such context as Belarus, it happens, there is a different connotation of this, because vlast becomes also not just an attribute, but some like a word that creates an identity in discourse. So people name those who are technically controlling the state as power, vlast, or vlast in plural, authorities in English, basically. And this kind of use creates a problem because something that's not supposed to be personal becomes personal. And this is called the metonymy, when you use one word in terms of another meaning, basically. Since this is the way people used to speak everyday, it's a habitual way of speaking, basically. So people got used to speak this way and don't pay attention to what words and in what way they're using. And this creates a problem, I guess. Through this kind of way of speaking, you just reproduce this personification of political power, which is not supposed to be an entity, a person, just supposed to be an attribute. So I guess, like, in basic terms, this is some problems that you can look at when you analyze political discourse.
I think it could be something similar in Polish language when we say władza. It's also etymological cognate, and we can say władza also about those governing us as władza. During the People Polish Republic, in Polish we said panie władzo, for example, to the policeman,
yeah,
or some other authorities.
Keeping this topic, I would like to ask you, we talk about the way the discourse is shaped, for example, with the word of power, but do you think it can affect us in some very practical ways? Do you see this also in behaviors of people?
I would say there is no like direct relationship, but there is some kind of correlation, right? Basically, some kind of relationship between how we speak and what we do and how we think about things. So because language is something that we use every day, it basically, based on the language, we create interpretation of the reality around us, right? So we interpret things based on how we call them. And then in this case, if we just use the words without paying attention to how we use them, it could reproduce this way of thinking about political situations and political process in the way that when we consider it's normal that a power is a person, not just an attribute of a person that is given to him by votes or by some other like legal process. But it's just like when we consider everybody who is in power as power, like equalize them this way. So this creates a problem because we reproduce it without second thought. And it can create problems because we just reproduce the status quo, basically. And there is no... It would be easier to change something if we think how we speak and if we pay attention to how we use words and maybe create different vocabulary or find alternatives or just make basically keep watch about ourselves how we speak and maybe like giving a second thought before pronouncing something. And then maybe it could result in changing the way we think about the political process, I guess.
So language isn't a neutral tool, how we describe the politics, but also it could create some situations, like some way of rhetorics could be propaganda and could have impact of what we choose, what we do. How would you define propaganda?
If you go into the originality of this term, it was related to advertising, right? So mm-hmm. to promoting something, basically propagating ideas. And currently, propaganda is related to ideology. And ideology is basically, if we look at discourse, ideology is something, it's just a way of interpreting things, right? So, and you can have different frames of interpretation, basically different number of ideas how to define things. And then when ideology mixes with political language, you can use this as a tool. And propaganda can use it as a tool as well if you basically propagate an idea with certain words and repeat it certain times, then it becomes basically a frame. And then through this frame, you can think about things in one way, you can push ideas in a particular direction. And this creates problem because if there are problematic words, in this case, political terms in the Russian language, propaganda can just pick them the way they are used, like with this personified meanings, and shape them around some ideas and promote these ideas with these terms. And then these terms will stick to these ideas and people will be basically using this word not just to define power as something personal, but also in the context of different ideas that are said by propaganda, basically. So this additional layer of problems is created by propaganda, if we speak about propaganda.
Could you give us some daily or maybe historical examples from Belarus, how it works, how it impacts the lives of citizens, their choices and politics in this country?
You mentioned only power, but I'm also curious, did you recognize any other words following up this question? Not only power, but also what else is propaganda there?
Yes, there were other words, like, for example, people, right? In English, people is one term, but in Russian, you have люди and народ. In Polish, Narod is like nation, right? But in Russian, there is another word, nacja. So we have nacja, ludzi, and Narod. Narod is basically the same root as nation, but nation is not used much in political discussion. Basically, Narod is like a general populace, and ludzi, you can trace it to leute, for example, folk, basically, right? So in, I guess in Polish, it's similar. Ludzi is ludzi, and Narod is nation, but in Russian, Narod is something different. It's just a general populace. When I analyzed official public discourse in media, these two terms were used in a passive way, basically, that somebody does something with people. But when you analyze regular citizens, how they speak on Facebook, for example, and opposition figures, their discourse, it's vice versa. People are active actors, they do something. And this is how they defined in interactions. And basically, you have the two different concepts of people, one which is passive and obedient, has no power, and must be just lives in a territory that is controlled by the state, basically. This is official's discourse, right? In positional discourse, it becomes a bit different, and people have power to do something. People is an active entity. They have sovereignty, basically. And this, it's just not just live in the country, but they are active political figures. Not figures, but active political, I guess, actors, right? So this is two different meanings that are created. We are the same, basically, word, right? Just the way you use it in different ways. Mm-hmm. And this can be picked by propaganda. If you go another layer, for example, you can say that, oh, people are not political figures. They are just living here. And we in power control them, and they must be obedient because otherwise they go against the state. So this is the official's discourse, how it works, if you unpack it. So this is kind of another example.
The words are actually, as I understand, are reproduced by politicians, but also by people in more automatic way. So it's like more automatic to accept it when we don't really think about the words. Do I understand it correctly? Like when someone says, people have to do something, and we are like, okay. And when you analyze it, you can see the layers which are actually there that we subconsciously reproduce in our daily choices. Yeah,
so basically, if you go look, if you ask some people in Belarus, will be speaking with just regular citizens, some mm-hmm. of them will be thinking the same way, like, oh, we're just simple people, we don't go into politics, we cannot do anything, they mm-hmm. are authorities, they are power, we are not. So mm-hmm. some people think this way, others think differently, like they are not they don't represent us because we are political actors, we did not vote for them. So, mm-hmm. and in this kind of different situations, but then it really reproduces like this. And some people really pick this discourse and repeat it but basically this mental kind of constructs that it creates, I guess.
Okay, so looking at it from the other way, you mentioned the opposition, which has a slightly different discourse. Do you think there is a way to break this discourse with some alternatives? So you slightly mentioned it, but could you elaborate more? Is it possible to change the discourse, and with the discourse, provide a change in politics, for example?
I guess like first thing that must be done, like maybe not must be, but could be done, is that such words as, for example, power and authority, власть, государство, should not be used in personified form. So there must be a distinction between a person who has power and power as an attribute that person gets, for example, and state as a just structure, just like a basically territory with institutions, not just people. Because it creates the same way, the word state, государство, people speak of it also like in this personified form. The государство is like a group of people who controls the state. So first, we need to stop thinking about state and power in personified form, and then maybe find some alternatives to these terms if they are problematic in Russian language, for example. And I don't think it's only in Russian, there are probably in other languages there are similar problems with maybe different words, but in this case, we could find alternatives or get words maybe from another languages. There were cases when people borrowed words from other languages to name something, for example, or just create a different word or stop using one word and find instead of power, use something else. I don't have the exact recommendation which words to use because I did not analyze that, but this is basically, I just found the problem.
Yeah,
and I highlighted the problem, and I think that one of the ways of kind of addressing it is to reworking the vocabulary we use mm-hmm. about politics.
Are some generations more prone to one kind of discourse and other generations see some change, or is it not really connected with age?
Might be connected, but not with this kind of top-level, high-level terms, as okay. Paul stated, because they basically permeate each discussion. Most of the discussions, and especially in public discourse, when you like read media or watch something, if somebody watches TV, it will be there. If people discuss it on Facebook, different ages of people, right? People of different ages, they use the same vocabulary. I don't know why, but these terms travel across the ages. Maybe some younger generations use them less, but still they use them. And the problem is not with the quantity, like how many cases of use are there, but in the specific way of using, basically.
Okay.
If this specific mm-hmm. way of using is reproducing through different contexts, mm-hmm. and different generations, it still creates a problem. So it's like basically contexts of use of the word need to avoid using it in a specific way. Mm-hmm. And this is the problem, yeah.
You analyzed, as you said, some speeches, but did you analyze also some other like press or, as you said, social media? Was it also a part of your study, or you focused on the official discourse? What did you study?
In my data, I analyzed two media outlets. One was more leaning toward official position, was Sputnik Belarus. Mm-hmm. Another was more or less neutral in less kind of official onliner. Both of them were web-based. And the reason I analyzed these two between each other, because I wanted to see, find the data from May 2020 to February 2028. So May 2020, when the election campaign started, and then was the referendum, which was held to change the constitution in Belarus. And basically, I was looking for media who have similar online audience and also who had reporters on the spot for the both of 2 years. Because some of the major independent media, such as Tutbai, for example, they were closed. And Belsat is in Poland, right? So they are not in Belarus. So I had to find two media that have like different positions, basically, from the political spectrum. Assuming that they might have different framing of issues. And that's why I analyzed these two. And then also I analyzed Facebook posts on the same political topics, basically. I picked up, I think it was 11 search terms, 11 different topics that happened during the period. Most prominent, like the news about Viktor Babariko, one of the candidates, or the search at Belapan, when the police raid onto the independent media agency, right? Such kind of news, or refugee crisis on Belarusian Polish border, for example, which was in both media outlets, and these topics were highly discussed in Belarusian population. And also on Facebook, I analyzed the same topics, and there I analyzed posts, only public posts, because some people changed their privacy settings after the protests, so it was not so much data as I expected, but at least I was able still to find some public posts and comments to the post and replies to this comment. So I was trying to see official discourse, independent kind of discourse, and regular people, basically, as much as possible. The idea was not just to quantify like how many mm-hmm. instances are there, even though there were like basically in the media and Facebook, more than 50% of cases had this key terms, one or two of them at least in each of the post or news article. So it shows that they're highly represented, highly...
repeated, yeah.
Repeated, frequent, right.
It's frequent, frequent in the discourse, yeah.
But the idea was to see if people discuss different topics with the same terms mm-hmm. and whether they use the same terms in the same way to discuss different topics. And this was the idea, basically, to see if it travels across different contexts. And this was, it showed that these words basically travel across different contexts, because it doesn't matter which political event you're discussing, there are still this kind of top-level words, such as power, state, or people, or sovereignty, or West, for example, right? That people would use to basically discuss it in terms of different identities. So they create different identities, like people against state, or people against power. And this is another problem, discursive oppositions that are created in this kind of context. So these terms allow to create identities and divide identities between different, basically, poles of political spectrum.
So it's like polarizing power, yeah? This is opposites or not really?
I'm not sure if it's about polarizing power, but it's more about like thinking of different groups, in terms of groups. Mm-hmm. There are power as a group, state the group, people as a different group. And in different discourses, for example, people go against state or West goes against state or sovereignty, something like this, like if you consider. Mm-hmm. And then you see like how these oppositions are created, and through these oppositions you can understand how different, basically, people, more liberal or less, more pro-state, for example, pro-officials, how they reproduce it in their discourse, in their talk, how they think about these entities. And you can divide it by different identities then. But it's a more detailed analysis then. It's another level.
Mm-hmm.
So this polarizing of this society serves the government to antagonize the people, we versus them, something like that?
So I'm not sure if it's done deliberately, but this is just the way things are, basically. This is the way people are used to speak. And this kind of repeats this kind of populist way of speaking, basically populist rhetoric, when you create like people against something, or somebody speaking directly to the people, or so these oppositions and different groups, out groups, like for example, West is against Belarus, or in groups, like there are some kind of extremists against those in power. And this kind of political rhetoric is reproduced, but it is reproduced by everybody. Or by opposition as well, by regular citizens as well, without second thought, because a problem is with the use of words, basically.
Who are they, the opposition and the extremists, according to government rhetorics?
So if you analyze speeches of like Lukashenko or some ministers or somebody, some officials, basically, specifically about the election period and around the constitution, for example, was an example, then I think it was somebody from Internal Affairs Office was speaking about people who want to staff invalid ballots, basically to spoil ballots with two access, like make two choices instead of one, because two choices spoils the ballot. They were saying that these people are going against their own country and we will find them because they're basically... in this context, they did not call them extremists, but in other contexts, they call everybody who does something against the official decisions as extremists or some kind of somebody who goes with a position who ran away from Belarus, so they are with Western countries against Belarus, and this kind of rhetoric is reproduced, basically, yeah. And I guess if you speak about the official's discourse.
So making the choice is something controversial and extremist.
Yeah, basically making your own choice, which is against the choice which is proposed to you by those technically controlling the state, will be considered more or less kind of extremist, yeah, if you especially do it publicly.
So the discourse is really skewed, yeah? It would be skewed towards so the very small things are portrayed as very huge, let's say, extremist stuff. For people in Poland, it would be weird to say, okay, so you voted, or you, like, in your ballot, you matched two things, so you're an extremist. So for us, think about it, it's like very, very skewed towards some absurd even. So I guess such a discourse really can be shocking for people in Poland.
But the problem is it does not stop on discourse. It goes in the real world because, for example, some examples like, that I guess recently they prohibited the authorities, Belarus official authorities, kind of. I don't know how to call them actually officially now, because this is also another problem of legitimacy, right? Mm-hmm. But those who officially control the state now, there were some messages that, I guess, the announcement that you're not allowed to take a picture of your own ballot while you're voting. But technically, it's supposed to be... kind of nobody should see how you vote, right? So technically, you just so how it works was before. Like I remember, for example, the referendum in 2020, they took out these curtains from the booth, right? So they can see you from the back. But before that, they had these curtains, and I was asking, why did you take off the curtains? And they say, oh, nobody will be watching, but they're supposed to be there. So this is kind of absurdity it goes. And then you cannot take a picture, you cannot share your picture publicly so that you can get in trouble. You cannot like something, you cannot comment something. You cannot think differently, do something differently. So it goes to these absurd things, and people really go to jail for this, or get fines, and you never know what you've done. Basically, they can find anything and then can
make it bigger. Let's say bigger in their discourse. Yeah, like this is extreme, even though it's like taking a picture. How is taking a picture extreme? Yeah.
And then it goes towards circumventing the law, for example, creating a law code which corresponds to the current understanding of what extremist is. And then they can switch it and tweak it and change it all the time. And you never know what will be illegal next day, basically. So this is the problem it creates if you go to the real world application of this.
So it seems like it starts from the language. Very often in our social media, we discuss the power of language, meaning some people argue that using a different word for a situation doesn't really change a lot. We had a huge discussion 2 years back when the invasion of Russia into Ukraine started in Poland. There was a huge discussion whether we should say "w Ukrainie," like in Ukraine, or na Ukraine, like literally mm-hmm. on Ukraine, so like a part of a state. So we created educational materials as our account. We created educational materials that we should say "w Ukraine" to use this preposition there. But many people said it's only language; it doesn't change anything. We should not focus so much. And as I understand from your research and from what you do, language is not only language; it's actually a lot.
Yeah, language is an action, actually, as mm-hmm. well. You do action, and then you create meaning. And then for Ukrainians, it is crucial that you call them "v Ukrainie," not "na Ukrainie," because it has political connotation. "Na Ukrainie" is some kind of "na Ukrainie," basically, right, in Russian. Something which is on the edge of Russian Empire, somewhere there. But "v Ukrainie" is in the country, in the national state, basically. And the same there was a similar problem with the name of Belarus, for example.
Yeah,
Russian, exactly. In Belarus, it's Belarus, but Russians... in Russia, usually spoke at Belarusia. But Belarusia was Belarusian Socialist Republic, basically. It goes to that term. And after that, that country does not exist anymore. Now there is a Republika Belarus, right? Or Belarus. But they had this huge dispute in Wikipedia about Belarus, in Russian segment of Wikipedia. And finally, they decided that Belarus should be used in Russian, but not for all cases still. And I don't understand why this creates a problem for some people who just are used to call country in a specific way and do not pay attention to how people who live in this country want to be called. So this is another thing. It's about identity as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so, for example, if somebody says, "Oh, my name is Mike," they say, "No, I will call you Peter."
Yeah.
Why? Because I'm Mike. Why are you calling me Peter? So this is the same problem, right? And words in this case are not just words. They create meaning, they offend people, they can lead to some real world applications or problems. So we need to pay attention to how we speak about things.
Yeah, this is a very important message, I guess, for the people who are following us, because we very often tackle this topic. I wanted to ask, because we talked about the discourse, the state, but also the West, how it's portrayed as extremist and stuff like that. But how about Russia? Is Russia present in this discourse? How is it? How is Russia portrayed, basically, by both official analysis, official statements, but also in the popular discourse?
From what I see, it is present in officials' discourse for sure, because there is this kind of, how do you call it, союзное государство, union state of Russia and Belarus, whatever it means, I don't know. But usually how it happened before, somewhere around New Year's, they were about to sign new contracts about gas and petroleum, right? To buying them from Gazprom or somewhere. And around this time, there were a lot of topics speaking about Russia, because they were arguing about prices and signing this agreement, something like this. But in official discourse now, like Russia comes up in the context of this union state or in the context of other events, or they just, like, for example, like Lukashenko likes to, I don't know why he likes to speak about what Putin might think or what he really wants, like mind reading. So these kind of things. I guess people speak about it, but it depends on who. Like for officials, it is important. For those who are maybe in opposition or just regular citizens, they just don't speak about it like every day, but sometimes when something concerns Russia, when the war in Ukraine started, this full-scale invasion in 2022, there was a lot of discourse about Russia and Ukraine and the war and what happening. But then when there are no major issues, it just basically either disappears or either is not so present. Same with West, for example. It is needed only when somebody from officials or, you know, just somebody needs to contrast what is happening in Belarus with somebody like West as a collective actor, whatever it means. What is the West? Is it European Union? Is it United States? Is it Canada? Is it liberal democracies? Or is it just Western from Belarus?
Is it Poland, actually? Like,
is it Poland? Yeah. So what do you mean by this? And this is another problem, this abstraction. When you use abstract terms, it creates problems because you can use West and you can interpret it in different ways. But for officials, it is important. For example, when there was this landing of civil aircraft when Roman Protasevich, for example, if you remember this case, what happened, they used the fighter jet to intercept the airplane. They landed them. And then they were speaking that West or Western actors are not following their own policies. So that in this kind of context, they say that we are open, we show you all the information, but they are not following their own policies, not showing all the information about this accident or something like this. So they use it either to show themselves as better than some in the West, whatever it means, or show that West has some kind of wants to do something with Belarus. Like, for example, it was during the presidential election or before that, I think that somebody like Lukashenko was speaking about some kind of tanks which are moving around Belarusian borders or something like this, like NATO and West doing something around, some kind of conspiracy thinking.
So generally Poland is perceived or presented in this discourse as a part of West only?
I guess in official discourse, Poland will be as a part of West, especially because it's more or less liberal. Democratic state, it's in European Union, it's a part of NATO. So in this kind of terms, it is a part of West.
So there is no something like thinking about Poland as our neighbors.
When you speak about political discussions, political. It usually appears as part of West. But then for regular people, sometimes like Lithuania or Poland becomes like neighboring countries. But official discourse created problematic because it makes it problematic for people in Belarus. Think about these countries, especially those who are lean more toward support, for example, those who are in power now, right? They do not think about Poland or Lithuania as merely neighbors. It's always politically loaded understanding of these countries because they are like liberal in European Union, they're in NATO, they're not us, they're different, they do something against us, and then Lukashenko says they do something against us, that's why we think about them more or less negatively. So these kind of things it creates, this like line of chain of thinking, basically. But then if you're a person who does not support, for example, the official regime, you could call it like this way, for example, or if you live abroad from Belarus, or if you live in Poland. So these people, I don't think many of them consider Poland as West or something, it's just Poland as Poland, something which is culture is close to Belarusian in some point, in some cases, like language is close as well. So there are a lot of connections for me as well. Like I came here 2 years ago, and for me it seems really close. Basically, it's easier to adapt because culturally there are a lot of connections. But this is not the way officials think about it. They don't think about culture. They think more about this kind of political interactions, or like this term geopolitics, but it's not a good term as well because it's a problematic concept.
Yeah, I would also say Polish people don't consider, I don't say for speak with everyone, but most people wouldn't think about us as the West. We would also make oppositions towards the West, like, oh, okay, in Poland it's okay, but in the West it's like crazy or something like that. So even like in everyday discourse, people, maybe not so much in the politics, because in the politics I guess we want to be included and seen as a part of the West. So it's really interesting to see this contrast. And here casual people see themselves as, yeah, we're in Poland, we don't think about being West, East. We think we are like the center of the world, jokingly. But in general, I think everyday lives, people don't think about themselves.
It depends. Generally, some people are very close to thinking about Western values as yeah. as their own. But generally, many people in Poland would say we are not the Eastern Europe.
But also some say we are not the West. So we're like, just a joke like you said, in the center. But yeah, just to add a perspective for Polish listeners, that it's interesting that the concept of the West can be so differently understood also on so many levels in our discourse, especially right now. Right now, when we see the political discussion regarding the Trump's choices, what Trump said and how Poland tries to be the part of the West, and even though people don't really consider themselves as we are the West. Yeah,
I guess if you just look at the countries in Eastern and Central Europe, many of these people in these countries might have similar concepts, like mm-hmm. considering themselves not as West, and like Germany, for example, or France or Great Britain, somebody West, right, or United States. And I guess this is kind of common cultural problem of this whole region, maybe, because but you need to dig deeper in the history to explain why this happened and analyze it. I don't have data now to.
Yeah, we just to make a comment so that it's relatable to our listeners, so that it can also, as you said, it's really important to not only use your words, but also think how we use them. So it came to my mind that in our discourse, we also use it in like different ways on different levels. So that's really interesting to see here.
And also you mentioned Trump, for example, and if you mm-hmm. consider Trump, it's actually a good example of how kind of these abstract terms are used. So he said like America great again, or like mm-hmm. something like this kind of slogans he uses, and then saying like Russia, they don't want to do something, or Ukraine want to do. So using the name of a country as a unit of analysis, basically. But the nation state, this is a problem actually of thinking in terms of nation states, because in this thinking of international relations, especially realism perspective, when you consider that there is somebody like superpower or somebody against everybody, and then each state becomes like a single actor. But if you divide how many people live in Poland, 38 million or around 40 million, right? Or how many? Yeah, I don't know the exact number.
39, yeah.
39?
Yeah. Something like this, yeah.
So 39 million people. But in these terms, you'll consider Poland as one. If you mm-hmm. say Poland wants to do something, right? This is the same metonymic substitution, because you assume the whole population of Poland, the whole country, is one person when you think speak about like this kind of geopolitical terms. And then it is important in this case to divide, to see how many people think differently, what kind of groups are there, and then within the groups, what kind of ideas travel around, how they change. So and then Trump uses this top level of abstract terms, which creates another problem. Same problem is populism and this abstraction and metonymy. So it's similar to this Belarusian case, but different words, basically, and different examples.
So when talking about the metonymy and taking some group as one living entity, how to say, animating it mm-hmm. like one governing person, like in an authoritarian system. So I have a question. Why in authoritarian systems the government, the authority doesn't say we people want something?
But I think like they can say this, but it will not be real. It will be basically playing with words. Like, for example, in Soviet Union, they said Sovetskiy narod, Soviet people wants this, or we do this for the Soviet people. So they operate this terms, but they use them for their specific purposes. Technically, for the authoritarian leader, if he wants to, he or she, I don't know, like if they want to control the whole country, it is necessary to be sure that there are no opportunities to overthrow the government legally, officially, so people do not have basically any power to do something. And then you can speak about people. Lukashenko also speak like about narod and people and Belarusians in these terms, that just some kind of, I don't know how to explain what is the purpose of this, but basically just to say they want to probably highlight that, like, for example, there is an example, this of Всебелоруське народне собрання, this, I don't know, all Belarusian people's assembly, basically. It's an institution that Lukashenko invented. And technically he said, this is an example of direct democracy, because people go there and they elect their leaders, or they vote about, not what they discuss, some political problems. But technically, who comes there? People from state institutions, some managers, or some people who are approved by those from the authorities. And this is basically this kind of these officials in a miniature, basically miniature, like 4,000 or somewhere people who are from this same block, basically go there, pretend they discuss something. And then Lukashenko will say, this is people's choice. This is direct democracy. This is how people decide. So they kind of create this facade from people.
So in rhetoric, it gives the voice to the people, but in reality, it is the voice of the government that are saying in their name.
I guess so, yeah. It's more or less this problem that they show, okay, people present in our discussions, in our discourse, we attribute something to them, but technically they don't have any power.
Mm-hmm. So the people want something when it is something that could unite their will with the authority. In other ways, it's like something extremist, like, yes?
So I guess... So basically, in Belarusian context, they do everything that they can for people not to unite in any way. And then in 2020, there was a good example when people just like grassroots initiatives, they've been able to unite, collaborate, cooperate with each other, doing something without the, basically any interference from the authorities. So authorities disregarded the COVID pandemic, right? And then people organized themselves to address their own problems. And this is just one example, but these were many examples of different contexts when people organized. For example, there were problems with water in Minsk. People organized, they were bringing water to places where people had no access to fresh water, while officials were pretending they're trying to address the problem, but several days there were no water, basically, right? So people decided to address the problem themselves. And now it is more and more difficult to do this kind of things, even if it's not actually directly related to political contexts, even if it's just like it's some kind of people in the yard somewhere in the neighborhood organized, for example, to do a party. They will not be able to do it now if it's not permitted by officials. So it's like officials can speak about people in their official rhetoric, but at the same time, they do everything that people do not unite and do not do something instead of those who control the state. Because if they take, basically, address their own problems themselves, the people, then why do we need these people in the authority, right? If we do it ourselves. So, and this created this problem in 2020. And then I guess they understood it, the officials, that they need to do something with this. And then that they really... under all this severe repression on population.
So you, as a researcher of this topic, you talk about repressions a little bit. Is it also dangerous to study such things for people from Belarus, or the analysis of speech is not very controversial?
I guess it's difficult. It's a problematic as well. It can be dangerous because, like, if you followed the news, I guess maybe half a year ago, somewhere around that time, Belarusian authorities made this case, like they labeled as extremist probably 20 or 30 Belarusian scientists, scholars, and activists. Many of them are respectable scholars in Western academia. Again, we use this word West, okay, in European universities, American universities, right? And these people have been basically labeled as extremists and got like 20 or 15 year sentences. If they will return to Belarus, they will be arrested. And they prosecuted them without even them being there, those people in the court. So this is how it works. So basically, if you do research which is related to political topics, you might be in danger. So I don't know like how far it can go, but you never know because you don't know what they will consider as extremist or anti-official next day, basically.
So you also mentioned that people on Facebook hid their posts, like about some events. Would it be also, for example, possibly dangerous to publish or read such things as your work as well in the outlets in Belarus?
I'm not sure about exactly my work. It might be just not like official publications definitely will not go there. They will not permit it. If people just discuss it somehow without addressing specific political figures or not referring to some extremist resources, because there are so many independent media that also were labeled as extremist, and you cannot copy their posts, you cannot post their posts or share them, you cannot like interact with them if you don't want to get in jail, basically. So unless you don't do these things, maybe you can discuss, but still people hid their posts because they were afraid that they can get in trouble for just publicly discussing something about politics, about criticizing government. So we don't have this thing that's like in the United States, they have First Amendment, right? You can criticize the government, you can speak whatever you want, unless it's a hate speech, right? Mm-hmm. In Belarus, in the constitution, you have the freedom of speaking publicly, but in reality, you cannot. Mm-hmm. And in reality, you don't know which statement will be considered as extremist or which statement will get you in trouble, especially if you're inside the Belarus. So it's kind of dangerous for some people, and that's why it was difficult to get a lot of data, because many people hid their posts after the protests, especially when if somebody participated in the protests and spoke about it or shared some pictures or geolocation or anything that could lead to this person. Mm-hmm. And then also, like, yeah, they had these cameras all around Minsk, for example. They took pictures of faces. They've been analyzing them for several years after the protest ended. Mm-hmm. And still arresting people whom they found like 2 years ago walking somewhere in a protest march, for example.
Yeah,
so this is how high it goes. Yeah,
terrible situation. You talk about different ways of opposing the power of the state. How about the linguistic side of speaking Belarusian? Is speaking the not very popular language but still present considered as being a part of opposition? Because I've heard something like that. Is it true?
In some contexts, it is considered this way, especially like if you go a bit back to history, when we have this like BNF, Belaruski Narodny Front, it was one of the political parties and political movements in early 90s. And then Zenon Pozniak, he was leader of this. I think he's somewhere in either in Poland or I don't exactly know where he is, but he's in the European Union somewhere. Mm-hmm. And so I guess the Belarusian opposition in 90s mostly spoke in Belarusian. Not all of them. Then there were changes when they started using Russian as well. But then for officials like Lukashenko and his administration, it was easy to label those who speak Belarusian as extremists. Because like one thing they did, like I think it was 1995 or 1996, I think it was 1995 referendum in Belarus when they changed the status of Belarusian language. So they added like Russian language is also an official, and Belarusian and Russian became official languages. Before that, Russian was only the language of, I think it was what is called intercultural communication or something like this. It was not an official. Official was Belarusian. But then it changed, and then most of the paperwork, especially administrative paperwork, is in Russian, right? Like most of the discussions are in Russian. And then if you speak Belarusian, most likely for authorities, you'll be considered as somebody, okay, you go with this, like BNF, for example, or with those guys, or you are against the government, for example, you're oppositional. And then speaking Belarusian in public context also is problematic sometimes. Sometimes it's allowed when official, like kind of celebrations or something, like Dożynki or something like this. I don't know if you have something similar in Poland.
Yeah, we have Dożynki, yeah.
So yeah, but Dożynki was monopolized by officials in Belarus. Mm-hmm. They created a big deal of it. So every year they renovate one small town and then bring the whole stuff there. And then sometimes they use Belarusian, this kind of, but their Belarusian language is associated with this kind of
folklore, yeah, something like this.
Folklore, and also this idea of countryside, this kind of straw hats, this vyshivanka, this kind of peasant culture, and this is where Belarusian is okay for them. When Belarusian comes to public discourse, it becomes a problem. But there were, like, before the 2020, there were this kind of change, especially independent businesses, and many of them did advertising in Belarusian. They were translating movies into Belarusian, for example, or books into Belarusian. It was a big deal. It was growing, especially in the cultural sector. For example, the Belarusian language was getting momentum at some point. But then, again, after the protest, it was easy to label those who speak Belarusian as extremists, because of their affiliation with independent businesses, independent entities, NGOs, grassroots organizations, and so on. And many of this independent public in Belarus, especially grassroots and more liberal-minded, doesn't matter Russian or Belarusian speaking, they intersect somehow. Mm-hmm. They have something in common, especially their political stances. And that's why it was an easy target for the authorities to label those who speak Belarusian as extremists. So unfortunately.
I've seen some videos on social media of people, there's particularly one guy, and he was walking the streets of Minsk, and he was asking people, like, for example, do you know how to say coffee in Belarusian or how to say chai in Belarusian? And I was surprised because I thought, from what I knew a little about the situation with the linguistic situation, that it may be dangerous or someone may be labeled as an opposition when they use Belarusian. And there was the guy just walking in his camera, asking questions like, is Belarusian nice? Can you quote a Belarusian poet? And the second thing that came to my mind, maybe he's like accepted by the state and maybe he's there to show that, you know, to the young people, it's not so bad here. So there are several layers that you can go with analyzing such a situation.
Yeah, there are several layers. And also in this situation that you describe, it might be actually one of these cases when it's not so dangerous because mm-hmm. it's not explicitly political. It is not affiliated with some kind of public gatherings. It's not affiliated with doing some independent work which can be labeled as doing something against the Belarusian state, for example. So, but many cases are specifically related to public situations. They are dangerous. They create dangerous mm-hmm. context for using Belarusian language. Not always. For example, there was Artsadiba. It was an organization which was promoting Belarusian traditional culture, right? Belarusian language. They were organizing language courses and other some kind of different events. And they've been labeled as extremists because they were an independent organization. Mm-hmm. And basically, there were young people, many of them. Many of them were against, I guess, most of them were against what is going on in Belarus. And yeah, so there was this event when they closed the, I think there was a store that called Symbol Buy. I think it was affiliated with Artsadiba, but the store was selling some kind of Belarusian embroidery, vyshivanka, some kind of pins and different kind of how do you call it, merchandise basically, in Belarusian traditional colors and all these things. And then the authorities decided to close it, and then people went there, formed a huge line in the last day when it officially was permitted. And then actually police was patrolling this. Mm-hmm. They were ready to grab people. And actually they grabbed somebody from there. Mm-hmm. For people just staying in the line to support the independent business. So this is how far it goes sometimes. And this business was affiliated with Belarusian speaking audience.
Mm-hmm. We tackled a lot of topics. But for the people who are listening, I would like to also take some practical tips from you. Since you study discourse, you study how discourse is used to manipulate or how to control or keep the power. Are there any tips that you could give to our listeners what to look out for when they read the news about any country, really, but just what to look out for, what is dangerous, when should we stop ourselves and think, hey, maybe it's not okay.
So one thing which is important, I would say, like, look for these high level abstractions. Like, for example, when you speak like Trump, Ukraine wants to do something. Mm-hmm. So this is a problem because it creates this kind of unit out of the whole country, right? And then, for example, like, people gathered and did something. Like, which kind of people? So also for journalists, it's good practice to be more concrete, specific. Like, describe a specific person who did something instead of just assuming that a group does something, right? Mm-hmm. So when you read about any situation, you can first track this kind of abstractions like this. Like, when a country is attributed, like, when you make but basically personality out of the whole country or something like the similar situations. And then for the political terms, like in this case, like power, we mentioned in Poland, you had Pani Vladza, right? Or mm-hmm. something like this. So this kind of things as well, when something which is not supposed linguistically to be personified, mm-hmm. but it is used as a personified thing, you need to kind of look for these kind of things. See if something is used in its proper form, or if it's not used in a proper form and there is this metonymic change. When you use something in terms of something else, that one word starts meaning something else instead of its main meaning. So this is another thing that you could pay attention to. And then also another thing, maybe also when we speak about these high abstractions, which are not impersonal, when they become personified as well, and then they can be active or passive, for example, you can attribute agency to them, that they do something, like people are active, for example, or people just need to obey, they're passive, they follow somebody. So these kind of things also you could take a look into these problems if you notice that, for example, you say like, okay, Poland wants to go somewhere to the summit or something, so some kind of this. And then this creates a problem that it's not Poland wants to go, a specific person goes.
Mm-hmm.
And then Poland cannot go because Poland is a country and country is impersonal, basically. It's not like animated. It should not be animated, right? It's a name of the country, but it doesn't have
human property.
Agency itself.
Yeah.
But then somebody, a representative of Poland, can do.
Mm-hmm.
So it's also for journalists, like if you're like a representative of somebody, goes there and then speaks from, because he's allowed to speak from, because he got votes, right?
Mm-hmm.
He got mandate from people. So avoiding these high-level abstractions, avoiding personification, and avoiding this metonymic change when you speak of one thing in terms of another thing, when one word suddenly starts to mean something else. So these are problems that people could watch at when they read news or something, like discussions in social media or anywhere else.
I think there is also some another figure in rhetorics, some opposite figure, like depersonificate some people, like to say they are the wave of people, the mass of people.
Yeah, so this is this problem, creating this abstraction, mm-hmm. combining individuals into groups, then groups into mass. And then mass is something which you cannot understand. You can interpret it differently, like West, for example, or people. This is high-level abstractions because they're not divided into individuals and individuals do something. Instead, we have this kind of masses that do something.
Yeah.
And this is a problem.
So I guess it's easier to make someone fear the abstract, as you mentioned, entity of a big country like, I don't know, USA, Canada, or whatever country, but just an abstract entity of such a huge country. And we can be afraid of it because it seems unified when you, as you mentioned, abstract it into one entity. But in fact, there are people just like us in each places, and there are people with different ideas, with their empathy, with their personal opinions that are not mentioned in this huge label. So that's really, I think, an important message here. And as you mentioned, it's also, I know that some people from some journalists listen and read our social media, so it's also, I guess, an important message to them to be careful when they create the message about different countries, different entities, that they want to be more, should be more specific rather than general.
Also, I think that is important if it is top bottom or bottom top identification. Like the government could create your identity like mass or like their people accepting you, accepting the will of the government. But otherwise, the people themselves could unite and call mm-hmm. themselves as something that has some agency.
Yeah, so and basically this is like in Belarusian case, you have these two different discourses. For example, if you could divide it like oppositional discourse and officials discourse. Basically, this is the same way, like officials will be top down, and oppositional will be more down up from grassroots to the top. So this is different ways. But in any case, it's important to avoid this kind of shortcut thinking, shortcut labeling of things, because it's easier to think in shortcuts. But then in this situation, it's better to expand the idea and make it more concrete, because you can avoid a particular kind of potential problems if you mm-hmm. expand it a bit, make more effort in delivering your idea instead of doing shortcuts, because it's easier. But then shortcuts, since it's abstractions, there can be many interpretations.
Mm-hmm.
So this is another problem. So to avoid doing many interpretations, it's better to go into details each time.
I think it's a very powerful message. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed the conversation. It was really good conversation, I guess.
Dzięki wielkie za wysłuchanie tej rozmowy. Mamy nadzieję, że coś z niej wyniesiecie. Jeśli chcecie wiedzieć o nas więcej, zajrzyjcie na naszą stronę www.ojęzyku.pl. Mamy też social media, Instagram, Facebook, TikTok. Wszystkie nazywają się tak samo, O Języku. Do usłyszenia!